Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Ever since the first incarnation of this program over a decade ago, one of our go-to guests has been Bill Patzert. He helped pioneer the study of ocean-atmosphere interactions from satellite data and has been regularly featured by media outlets across the country. As you'll hear, he loves to talk about how the ocean affects us all, especially our weather, which has been increasingly prone to drought here in California. Bill and I have also shared our mutual love of surfing and surf culture, and I call him the Kahuna. If you ever saw the original Gidget movie from 1959 starring Sandra Dee, you know where that comes from. We're going to be joined by some special guests as well to celebrate Bill's distinguished career. His protege and colleague Josh Willis from NASA JPL in Pasadena, and Jerry Schubel, the director of the Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach. And I'm going to be joined by a very special guest co-host, our longtime producer and the composer of our theme music, Matt Schultz, who joins us from New York. So let's paddle out into the set, shall we? First, let's get to our conversation with Matt and I and Bill Patzert, who joined us from his home in Southern California. Bill, I'd like to know, how did your interest, because you're an oceanographer, how did your interest in the oceans first get started? Like when you were a kid or what?
Well, you know, my dad was a sea captain. During World War II, he captained these great convoys that supplied the Allies in Europe and in Russia. And after the war, he ran a little fishing boat out of Long Island. I originally came from the East Coast. And when I was even as young as 7 or 8 years old, I used to go out on this fishing boat with him off the Grand Banks with a couple of Portuguese fishermen. I worked for him, couldn't speak any English. And the fortunate thing was I never got seasick. And my dad really, he generated this interest in the ocean and in weather, because sailors are always interested in the weather.
Well, yeah, and the Grand Banks of off Newton, that area is like where some of the most dramatic weather is. I think they even made a movie about that.
That's right. Yeah, and so my dad was he was a really interesting guy. You know, he was a humanist, a union organizer, but he just loved everything environmental and about the ocean. And as at a young age, he gave me books like The Sea Around Us and Silent Spring. This is when I was still in middle school, by Rachel Carson. And that led to the Boy Scouts. And so I just could never get enough of it. And so as my education progressed and I became somewhat responsible, one of my great dreams was always to be a big wave surfer. And so after I graduated from Purdue, I applied for graduate school at the University of Hawaii, where they were starting a program in oceanography and meteorology. And in spite of all my worst intentions, I had some great mentors and really perked my interest not only in surfing, but in large-scale oceanography. It was the early days of El Nino research and large-scale climate research, the impact that the oceans have on our climate. And from there, my first job was at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Of course, I chose it because I had an office right on the beach and I could surf during lunchtime.
Where's your office now that you've retired, Bill?
Okay. Well, something happened to me at Scripps, an opportunity. I think I consider myself a risk taker. You know, what's the next frontier? A group of really great people at NASA were putting together in the early 1980s a program to study the oceans from space. And it was a bit of a risk. You know, the satellite business, you have to sell the satellite, you have to build it, then you have to fly it successfully. But in the early 80s, the pay was really lousy at the University of California. And so JPL tripled my salary. And I was off to from my cozy little office on the beach in La Jolla to Pasadena at the foot of the mountains here. And but it turned out to be wildly successful. You know, we put together the satellite oceanography program, the famous Topex Poseidon satellite, and we've had three follow-ons since then. We've been monitoring the ocean, El Niño, La Niña, and even global sea level rise for more than 2.5 decades now. And so that that little risk that I took to leave, you know, my surfing digs at Scripps and move to the foothills here in Pasadena really turned out no regrets whatsoever. And, you know, and of course, I had to give up my great surfing career, which, by the way, wasn't that great.
Well, you know, you're talking about your dad's, you know, your dad's career and his influence on you. And it makes sense that someone who's a sailor would care about the ocean and the weather and conditions and realize, you know, that that's a big thing in their life. And that's something that that directly affects them. But a lot of us landlocked people, we don't necessarily think about what's going on out there. So I wonder if that was that an inherent challenge in communicating? Is it like, is there an inherent challenge in communicating the importance of our ocean climate and what's happening in our oceans to us landlocked civilians?
Well, you know, some of the great literature of all times is about the ocean and man's fight with the ocean and adventures. You know, I remember reading Moby Dick when I was in the eighth grade. That's the kind of guy my dad was. And of course, later I found out it was a great morality tale. But for me, it was always a great adventure. And he gave me books by Joseph Conrad. And so for me, you know, the ocean was always the great adventure, the great challenge. And I think everybody feels that way about the oceans. There's some mysterious pull, you know, all the great poets, all the great songwriters. It's about the oceans. And of course, for me, I was spoon-fed all this.
For a lot of us, we don't see the connection that the ocean has to our weather and climate. And your whole career was built on making that connection clear. Could you just describe, and you know, what Matt was trying to get at there, I think, was, you know, how is it that the ocean, you know, dominates our weather? Because like this year, for example, we seem to have swung right back into a drought.
Well, you know, the oceans cover 70% of the planet, and they really give us the moderate climate, which really allowed life to develop on this pretty unique planet that we're on right now. So far, we really haven't discovered anything quite like it, certainly not in the solar system, but even in the nearby galaxies. And so everything is tied to the ocean. So from the earliest studies you have in school is that life really evolved out of the oceans. We came out of the oceans. Right? And it certainly figures that the climate that we have here on the water planet is really controlled by the oceans. Now, as from earliest times, some of the earliest scientists and explorers, of course, map the oceans, the great currents in the oceans that move heat around. And as we moved into the 20th century, we saw that there were great disturbances in the force in the ocean, where you'd have a tremendous accumulation of warm water or cool water, would be like El Niño and La Niña. And when these appeared, they had a tremendous impact not only on marine ecosystems, but also on terrestrial ecosystems and rainfall and weather. And so as the with the advent of the satellite age, where we could, for the first time, monitor the global oceans, which previously were so hostile and inaccessible, it became clearer and clearer that the key to climate variability was the oceans. And of course, from a 101 standpoint, that makes a lot of sense, because the atmosphere and the land have a very low heat capacity. They're dry. So they don't store much heat. Whereas the oceans, which cover most of the planet, have a very high heat capacity. And so the oceans are really the great flywheel of the climate system. They capture the heat, they release the heat, they control the climate, and even the day-to-day weather.
You mentioned El Nino and La Nina. I wonder if you would give us like your elevator speech brief primer. What are El Nino and La Nina for somebody who doesn't really understand what those terms mean?
Well, the name El Nino comes from the earliest days, Spanish fishermen off the coast of Peru and Ecuador noticed there would be an unusual accumulation of warm water, which would disrupt the great anchovy fishery and take the very, very dry deserts of Chile and Peru and turn them into great floods. And this would happen about every 5 to 7 years. And so the early oceanographers went out into the ocean and noticed that this was not just a local phenomenon. It was a Pacific-wide phenomenon. And it was associated, this accumulation of warm water around the equator, with a relaxation in the great trade winds, which blow from the Americas towards Asia. And what we found out is that the warmest waters are found in the western equatorial Pacific. But when those trade winds relax, there's a tremendous transfer of ocean heat, warm ocean waters from the western Pacific into the eastern Pacific. And when that happens, rainfall and temperature patterns, not only in the Pacific Rim, but also in Asia, in India, in Africa, we see what was usually dry turns out to be wet. And it precipitates either great floods or great droughts. And so these great droughts and great floods really, and when we look back in history, those are the great events that either civilizations flourished or they collapsed. And so, you know, people began to realize is that probably the largest single impact on human civilization is climate change generated out of the great oceans.
It's time for a short break. When we come back, we'll hear from Bill's close friend and colleague from NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, Josh Willis. Stay with us. You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. I'm your host, Dave Shlom. And we're back. Before we return to our conversation with Bill Patzert, let's hear about him from someone who knows him very well, fellow NASA oceanographer and climate scientist Josh Willis. Hey, we are talking to our good friend Josh Willis from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Josh is an oceanographer and an expert on climate, and you've worked with William Patzert, Bill Patzert, over the years, haven't you?
Big Bill. Absolutely. Yes, I have.
Tell me about the first time you ever met Big Bill.
Well, I guess I first met him when I first gave a lecture at JPL. I was still a graduate student down at UC San Diego at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And I came up and I talked about ocean warming. And at the end of my talk, Bill told me it was a great talk because he says that to all young speakers just to boost their confidence. And then he said, you used real data. And then he started picking on all the people who ran models in the room. And instantly we became friends.
Wow. And when did you actually start to work with Bill?
Well, I finished my PhD and started working at JPL in 2004. And Bill started darkening my door right away. And he would walk in and talk to me and give me advice. And then a couple years later, I got hired as a full-time JPLer. I started as a postdoc. And somewhere in all that, Bill started to get this parade of young undergraduate students and interns. And he needed help figuring out what to tell them to do and working with them. And so I started working with Bill and a whole long list of undergraduates who really did some amazing research while they were there.
Can you put his career, in, as far as you've been working with him at least, into perspective? What is the legacy of William Patzert as an oceanographer and climate expert at JPL and for all of us?
Well, I think there's two things that Bill will always be remembered for. One is El Nino, and the other is having a big mouth. And I mean that in the most affectionate way. Bill loved to talk about the climate and oceanography, and he helped tell the world about the importance of doing oceanography from space. And he often did it in the context of talking about El Nino. So he would explain what was going on in the Pacific Ocean, and he would use data from what was then a brand new NASA and French satellite that painted a picture of it like never before. And he really put oceanography on the map for, I think, a huge part of the population that didn't know the oceans were important, didn't know NASA was studying them, didn't know we could see them from space. And I think he brought these things home, not just to his colleagues, but to a very wide audience.
And that was what, Topex Poseidon? Is that the mission you're talking about?
That's right. Topex Poseidon launched in 1992, captured the El Nino of the century in its third or fourth year in 1997-98. It saw this enormous El Nino event brewing in the Pacific Ocean. And Bill was one of the first people to say, hey, this is going to be a big deal. It's going to have a huge impact on California weather. And he was right.
And he's become, over the years, really a go-to guy for the media, especially in Southern California, hasn't he?
Absolutely. You know, Bill has a unique way of explaining things. And you know, he connects with people. I think that's why reporters and communicators always go to him, because he really puts it in terms that people can relate to. I like to say he was sort of two parts Rodney Dangerfield, one part Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Can you give me an example of some of that? Give me a story about something, an interaction you had with Bill where you got a bit of that Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Well, you know, a couple things. I mean, of course, Bill coined the phrase Godzilla El Nino. And actually, he started saying that back in 1997 when the El Nino was beginning to fade. The pattern of sea surface elevation measured by this Topex satellite, it kind of looked like Godzilla. If you squinted your eyes, you know, it looked like a dragon or something. And so he dubbed it the Godzilla El Nino. And it seemed silly at the time. It was what a ridiculous thing to say. But people really remembered it. And especially when he kind of reused it in the last El Nino, it really became a reminder that, you know, it was a big deal. And so I think his ability to kind of grab these memorable phrases and use them as tools to teach people and inform people, I think what made him a sort of a wizard in a doofus's disguise.
What's Bill like at work when you run into him at the hall, around the hallway?
Bill is never one to let you get away with anything. You know, I remember when I first started coming to JPL, ripped jeans were kind of in fashion. I had a pair of ripped jeans. And every time he saw me, you know, he would tell me, so what's the matter? You can't afford new pants? You know, I can loan you some money if you need to go get some new jeans. And, he would always give people a hard time, but not just about silly life things, about work too. You know, he was never shy about telling people that what they were doing was BS. And, as grading and as coarse as that sounds, it's helpful sometimes, I think, especially in science, you know, to have someone challenge you and really justify why what you're doing is important. And Bill served that purpose kind of, you know, to everyone, sometimes to people's irritation. But I think as a whole, it definitely made the science community around him stronger, because we were always answering that question. Oh, well, you know, Bill's going to give me a hard time about this one.
What's the most important thing you ever learned from Bill?
Well, I think it was to keep chasing my science goals and not get too distracted with pushing papers around. You know, it's pretty easy as you move along in your science career to slide toward a job that, you know, doesn't have you quite as much in the trenches and is a little more comfortable. And I think Bill always pushed me to keep doing interesting science, you know, to keep asking interesting questions and also ask new questions. You know, one thing he always said was, don't redo your PhD for 30 years for the rest of your career. You know, you already did that one, so find something new to work on. And I really took that to heart. During my career, I started working on ocean warming. Then I worked on the ocean conveyor belt that's often referred to. We call it the overturning circulation in the Atlantic. Now I'm studying Greenland, flying around in airplanes, trying to measure oceans and trying to learn something about ice as well. And so I think he really helped push me to not stagnate.
And has he ever taken you surfing?
He has not. He owes me one.
Well,
I'm like the last oceanographer who doesn't surf either, so I need some lessons.
Bill will teach you.
I know, and he better, because he owes me.
Get you out there on his longboard and get you on some little waves, and get you to paddle in there and stand up and feel like, you know, a real Malibu surfer guy.
Exactly. That sounds good.
Hey, thanks, Josh. Thanks for sharing your impressions with William Patzert, Bill Patzert, who's not dead, just retiring. And we hope to keep him around, you know, as a guest here and there. But I know he's going to be missed at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Definitely. Thanks for having me, Dave. It's already way too quiet on our hallway. We miss him.
Thanks to that insightful look at Bill from Josh Willis. You're listening to Blue Dot, and I'm your host, Dave Shlom. Now let's get back to Matt Schultz and I interviewing Bill Patzert. He recently retired after 4 decades studying the oceans from space at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena.
I've heard of this thing called Godzilla El Nino, and it sounds really cool, but I don't know what it is. Bill, I was hoping you could help me out.
Okay. Well, you know, all these great events, sometimes they're small, sometimes they're medium, sometimes they're large. And we produce these images out of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, these NASA images that we all became so familiar with. They're round images of the Pacific with great red and white blobs indicating El Nino, or blue and purple indicating cooler waters of La Nina. And during the great El Nino of 97-98, which really my career took off with that El Nino, one of the images that was produced just happened when you looked at it. I was at giving a talk in a middle school in South Central LA, and I always ask the kids what the images remind them of, you know, sort of like a Rorschach test. And some little guy in the first row stood up and he says, "That looks like Godzilla," right? And so, of course, it stuck with me. And on the evening newscast, about a week later, I said, and, you know, explaining the image, this is the Godzilla El Nino. And when the great El Nino of a couple of years ago, 2015-16, showed up, right, some reporter picked up on it. And I got tagged with being the father of Godzilla El Nino. But it really wasn't me. It was that little kid in the front row there in South Central in Boyle Heights.
So if you're listening out there, little feller, who you're probably not a little feller anymore, but a grown-up guy, you need to let us know, because you need to take credit for that.
Yeah, no, he didn't want to take credit for that. Of course, I took a lot of flack for that, Matt, you know.
Because you're sensationalizing something?
Exactly, yeah. But it was sensational. The great 97-98 El Nino and 2015-2016, they were spectacular. They generated floods, droughts, and tremendous droughts, for instance, in South Africa, where whole regions were displaced, where people had to evacuate. And so these are spectacular events, which has a tremendous impact on the local economies. And of course, as the world's population has exploded, and many of these civilizations or communities become more and more precarious, these great events have even a larger impact. If we look back in the history of El Nino over the last 200 to 300 years, so there were El Ninos and failures, for instance, of the Indian monsoon over Southeast Asia, where literally millions of people starved to death during these great events. And so, you know, we tend to take it for granted here, and it becomes a media event. But in many places in the world, it can be extremely devastating.
Well, and that's, going on now in Cape Town, South Africa, where the drought is so bad, they're talking about literally running out of water in a city.
Well, that's an interesting thing you mentioned, that because that drought has been going on not just for a year, but it's for more than a decade now. And it's one of the things that we learned from studying the satellite data is that it's bigger than El Nino or La Nina. There are what we call decadal changes in the ocean circulations, in the ocean temperatures. One feature we call the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, where the tropical Pacific can be extremely warm or cool, not just for a year or two, but for a decade. And for instance, from the mid-40s to the mid-70s here in California, we had almost 30 years of drought. And in some ways, the last 20 years, beginning in 1998-99, after the big El Nino, we've really been in a drought here in California, on and off, more or less, for the last 20 years. For instance, here in Southern California, in the last 20 years, only 5 of the last 20 years have had above normal rainfall. So I like to say we've never gotten out of the big drought, the decadal drought. And El Niños have come and gone and La Niñas, but on average, California has been dry for almost 20 years with 4 or 5 wet years thrown in between.
Yes, and if you look back at last year, which was very wet, record-breaking amounts of precipitation, this year has flipped us right back to the La Niña pattern, hasn't it?
Yeah, this is really the second year of La Niña after the big El Niño. And often we see in California that the second year of La Niña is the drought year. And it's been punishingly dry here in California. We've had up and down the state, from Northern California to San Diego, is that it's been exceptionally dry in November, December, January, and even into February. So this has been a very, very dry winter. And of course, what I said the other day is that if we don't have a miracle in February and March, we've definitely backflipped into the drought again. Or the other way to look at it is that we had one wet year last winter, but we never really did get out of the drought.
What do you think, in all your expertise and years dealing with the media, what do you think that the media will get wrong about that?
Well, I think the media, looking over my career the last 46 years, is that the media is much better informed. They're more knowledgeable. Many of the journalists actually have environmental educations, and they get it more right than wrong. Actually, just before I talked to you, I talked to Paul Rogers in San Jose, and we were just talking about the drought about 20 minutes ago.
I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about a different kind of climate, the political climate, because there's a movement, a force, whatever you want to call it, that wants to take NASA away from Earth observation and move it to away from that. And your entire career is based on studying the Earth and specifically the ocean climate system, and it seems to me that directly affects our lives and our economy. What do you think about what's going on with the state of politics today?
Well, things tend to repeat themselves. There are many existential threats to civilization, to the environment, climate adaptation. And in the short term, we're seeing some really frightening things. This new administration, probably the largest existential threat to civilization is really the Trump administration, is that all the hard-fought environmental legislation that we fought for in the 60s and the 70s, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, those are all being reversed with the various appointments he's made with his administration. And just the fact that there's this movement afoot among many in the far right towards what we call science denial, is that they think that science is a matter of opinion, not necessarily a matter of fact. And science is all about facts. And we are living in a warmer world. We're living in a world that's melting. Sea level is rising, which is the unequivocal proof of global warming. And all the hard-fought environmental laws and the legislation are being reversed. And that will do irreparable damage. It will take decades to recover from that kind of legislation. Then in the middle term is that what's the biggest existential threat with regards to the environment? And I'm going to say something that'll surprise you guys. It's population. Here in California, in the last 60 years, the population has quadrupled in a semi-arid environment. And so the question that really faces Californians, are there enough resources in other words, enough water resources to sustain our civilization, is the allocation of water between urban, industrial, and agricultural users, is it equitable or is it doable? And I contend, unless we do some dramatic things, the thing that will get us in the long run is not global warming, is the lack of adequate water resources. And we see that all over the planet. With 7.3 billion people on the planet and almost 90% of the water allocated to agriculture, all right, it's probably not sustainable. Now, of course, looking out to 2100, there's no doubt that global warming could essentially make large areas of the planet uninhabitable. We're warming at an alarming rate. The great ice sheets are melting. Sea level has risen almost 9 inches since the end of the 19th century. You know, beaches in California are disappearing. The great forests are moving to higher altitudes. There's more than 120 million dead trees in the national forests in California. And that's those impacts are accelerating. And so we have to deal with all these problems.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll hear from Jerry Schubel, Bill Patzert's longtime friend and director of the Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach. You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Schlom. And we're back. Before we finish our conversation with Bill Patzert, let's hear about him from his friend Jerry Schubel, the director of the Aquarium of the Pacific. You're listening to Blue Dot on NSPR. We're talking to Dr. Jerry Schubel. He is president and CEO of the Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach. And welcome to Blue Dot, Jerry.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
I'd like to just first find out, how did you first meet Bill Patzert?
Well, I met Bill before I came to the Aquarium of the Pacific in 2002 because for 20 years I was the Dean of Marine Sciences at Stony Brook University in New York. And so I used to go to many of the same meetings that Bill did. And then, so we knew each other, but not terribly well. After I got here, then we got acquainted much more intimately, and we began to use Bill in a lot of the programs, because he's a terrific expositor of science for the general public.
Do you happen to have, and it's okay if you don't, like a favorite story about Bill, maybe something humorous or an experience you've had with him?
Well, I've had many humorous experiences with Bill. I think he's very unpredictable. The only thing that is predictable about him is he'll be unpredictable in whatever situation he's in, and I like that in him. So when we've had him on panels and in programs, you can't program Bill Patzert. And he's spontaneous, and I guess at the last meeting that we had here of the League of Women Voters, Bill was the cleanup speaker of a panel of four, and he used the opportunity to talk to the League of Women Voters about the responsibilities they have of getting people out to vote. So he wasn't hesitant about giving his views about people who are in office now and what we need to do if we're going to use science in helping us get out of some of these messes we're in.
And now that he's retired, are you still going to try to keep him involved there at the aquarium?
Oh, he's retired, but he can't hide. No, we will continue to use Bill, and he's agreed that he will continue to work with us on our program. So by all means, we will keep him involved.
Well, that's wonderful to hear for you and all of the visitors at the aquarium. Just before you go, one last thing. What's your favorite thing about Bill Patzert's way of communicating?
The clarity, the candor. He never minces words. He's just a very, very good communicator. You know, he won the prestigious AGU medal for communicating science to the public. And he tells stories that are sticky. So unexpected, emotional, sticky stories is what he's good at.
And do you know Bill personally at all? Do you guys ever hang out?
I know Bill personally, yes. And after the last League of Women Voters program, he and my wife Margaret and I went out for a late lunch.
Well, I bet that was a lot of fun.
Yes.
And, you know, famously, he loves to surf. Have you ever gone surfing with Bill?
No, I'm not a surfer.
You're going to let him teach you how to surf?
No.
Probably a good idea, Jerry.
He can teach me a lot of things, but surfing is not one of them.
All righty. Well, thank you for spending the time with us today to talk about your friend and friend of the Aquarium of the Pacific, Dr. Bill Patzert.
Thank you for inviting me. I've been wanting to tell the world what I think about this guy for a long time, and you gave me the opportunity.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. That's kind of what this show is going to be all about. Thanks to Jerry Schubel, director of the Aquarium of the Pacific, for that. And now let's wrap up our conversation with the man of the hour, Bill Patzert. I'm joined by our former producer, Matt Schiltz. I'm Dave Shlom, and this is Blue Dot. I'd like to switch gears to talk a little bit about looking back at your career. When did you really first start enjoying or getting involved with dealing with the media, with folks like us? When did that really get going for you?
Well, you know, it really started with the great El Nino of 97-98. We had these tremendous images, the way to visualize the large El Nino. But let me go back a little earlier. At the beginning of my career, I wrote my dissertation for my PhD on a Selectric typewriter. All right. And what we did back in those days is we came into our offices with a yellow pad of paper and a pencil and started working out and actually solving equations by hand. But the tremendous changes happened in the 80s and the 90s. For instance, Dave might remember, but I had my first desktop computer. I think it was 1984, mm-hmm. 83 or 84. That was a revolution.
Little floppy disks.
Floppy disks, all right. Word processing, all right. Desktop computing. And then when we hit the early 90s, all of a sudden, to complement desktop computing, which, you know, over that 10-year period really evolved rapidly, was the World Wide Web, the Internet, which was just getting started and reaching its, what I call its real momentum in the late 90s, when the great El Nino, when we were flying the Topex Poseidon satellite. So with desktop computing, the Internet, it became a global phenomena with NASA launching satellite communications, desktop computing, the World Wide Web, right? The Japanese were mass producing relatively inexpensive, reliable TVs. And all of a sudden, the world became connected. And then it wouldn't have been possible 20 years earlier, this great communication thing. And of course, the other thing that a lot of it is just serendipity is that JPL is located less than 45 minutes from most of the mass media in the world. LA is the second largest communication hub in the United States. And so we've got them all here. And so with the World Wide Web, LA being a communications, you know, a global communications center, and not only that, less than 45 minutes drive to JPL, all of a sudden, my fame just took off like a rocket ship.
Do you have a favorite story of, like, maybe something humorous dealing with, like, a major media outlet with something that happened along the way that you looking back on was kind of funny?
Well, the 97, 98 El Nino was great. And of course, there are many, many stories. But halfway through the winter, I had this leak in my roof. And the leak was coming into my bedroom. If you ever have a leak in your in the ceiling, a drywall ceiling.
Oh, yeah.
You know, drip, where it turns into a big bubble sitting above your bed. ABC News one night wanted me to come down and do an interview. And I told them I couldn't because I was waiting for the bubble to burst in my bedroom. And so they sent a camera crew down, right, into my bedroom. And the reporter and I stuck a screwdriver in the 50-gallon bubble, all right, and caught it all in about 3 50-gallon garbage cans on national TV. That was a good one.
Bill, what are you going to miss about working at JPL?
Well, of course, it is a great cafeteria, you know, so at least I would get one square meal a day. That was it. But, you know, the one thing I learned at working at JPL, when you do these great satellite programs and you do something as large as studying global climate, it's really the whole venture is made up of teams of engineers and scientists working together. And so, I would never have called myself a team player being a surfer. But one thing I did learn is how much you could accomplish when you have, you know, I have so much respect for the really smart, dedicated people that I worked with at JPL. There was never such a thing as a 40-hour week there. Is that, you know, I've had a 35-year career where people just didn't want to go home. And I'll definitely miss all those people because you know, they were smart, they were inspirational. And as a team, we accomplished, you know, so much together. So it's always about the people, Matt.
It's awesome, man.
Well, we started our conversation talking about surfing, and I'd like to end it there because we have our nicknames for each other. Of course, for me, you are the Big Kahuna, and you have a nickname for me.
Yeah, it's Goofy Foot Dave from Southern California. Huh? Yeah,
that's right.
He's a surfer out of water, you know.
And I'm just wondering, you know, I'm imagining you in your retirement, sitting around listening to Dick Dale music and waxing your longboard. But are you gonna spend some time hitting the beach and doing some more surfing these days?
Yeah, you know, right now I'm looking into a trip down to the Galapagos. It was always on my bucket list. You know, what a fan. You know, we should go, Matt.
Let's go, man.
Let's go to the Galapagos, you know.
Field trip.
Let's go walk in Darwin's footsteps. Yeah.
I was thinking we could make a really cool documentary, Surfing the Galapagos, with Bill Patzert.
Yeah, that sounds like one of those Dan Brown movies, you know. Yeah. Okay, you guys, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Hey, you know, by the way, you know, they didn't pull the plug on my brain yet, right? And so as we look forward here, and let's just look at, we've had a couple of decades of fairly dry climate here in California with a few wet years stuck in between. And we've had more La Niñas than we've had El Niños. And, of course, the population during that period has tripled and quadrupled. And so there's a big stress on the water systems. And so one of the things we're really going to have to think about here in a changing climate, which is a warmer climate and probably a drier climate, we're really going to have to think seriously about the allocation of water here in California. And essentially, you know, how we better manage our water, because all great civilizations always hinge on the availability of water. And California really is one of the great civilizations. All by itself, it's the sixth largest economy in the world. But the climate of the 21st century is not going to be the climate of the 20th century. And so the times are changing.
Well, Bill, I would like to bestow upon you a title that you are now hereby declared the oceanographer, climate scientist, emeritus for Blue Dot.
Oh, man. You're making me blush, you know, because I've had, you know, so much fun talking with you, Dave, and Matt, and you guys are doing a great job up there and dealing with all kinds of topical issues. And so keep up the good work. I don't want you guys to be emeritus anytime soon.
Hey, thanks, Bill. Aloha, and we will stay in touch, Kahuna.
All right, Goofy Foot, keep it up.
All righty. Bill Patzert, freshly retired from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And Matt Chiltz joining us from New York. Matt, thanks a lot.
It's so good to join you. And shout out to Nolan behind the board, making it all happen.
Thanks so much to all of our guests today, co-host Matt Chiltz and the FOBs, Friends of Bill, Jerry Schubel, and Josh Willis. And I want to give a special thank you to Alan Bias, one of the media relations specialists at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. It was Alan that first connected me with Bill a decade ago, as well as Josh Willis. He's also helped us in contacting Jerry Schubel from the Aquarium of the Pacific. Alan's a consummate professional, and I really appreciated his assistance in putting this show together. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org or subscribe to our show through NPR Podcasts on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Schlom. Our theme music was composed and performed by Matt Chiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and co-produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot. And oh yeah, aloha kahuna.